la route dans un cirque ambulant où sa mère dansait pour attirer les gens. Son père veillait sur toute la troupe, chantait des cantiques et vendait l'élixir du bon docteur Glou.
Voleur bohémien,
c'est ainsi que l'on parlait d'elle et de sa famille.
Voleur bohémien,
et toutes les nuits les hommes lui tournaient autour en espérant l'amour. Elle a ramassé tout près d'Avignon un gentil garçon, mais un peu vagabond. Elle avait 16 ans, lui 19 et demi.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Hey Kids Comics. This one's been a long time coming. I'm Andrew Farmer, your host, as always. With me, the I'm going to call him D.A. Cole Houston. D.A. Jedi Cole Houston for this episode. The ADA Houston.
Yeah, well, I deflated, I think, would be a good...
Well, I think this is one of those episodes that, you know, in between segments of the episode and natural breakpoints, we need to have that Law and Order, dong-dong, that Law and Order sound in there. This has been a long road, Cole, and there are 100 things that we could talk about on the show tonight. Anything from DC Rebirth to Captain America to...
Yeah, in fact, I think this will be a good... kind of an opportunity to get DC Rebirth out of my thoughts.
Yeah. If you've listened to the show ever, you know, you understand, without spoiling it, you understand why Cole is remiss to discuss the new DC Rebirth comics. Frankly, I was a little shocked, and not in a good way. It's like kind of like finding a roach in your beans. That kind of shocked, but...
Especially after you've been crunching into them, perhaps.
Exactly, for crunching into them for 70-odd years, and all of a sudden there's
the
roach.
You discover it turns out they weren't really beans. They were just, it wasn't pork and beans, it was cockroaches and beans.
It was just little shame pellets that you were shoving inside of yourself, just waiting for this moment to bloom into a mighty pain oak.
And the thing is, I can't, with all... complete and total honesty, say that I didn't see this coming.
Well, I think you talked about it back on the USG.
I was, you know, once DC got their hands on this thing, they could not, and they proved that repeatedly, leave it alone.
Before Watchmen, they just...
Before Watchmen was the beginning of the end. Because they, you know, they had this thing that was decidedly done. I mean, this thing served its purpose, and they simply couldn't let it do that because everything's a commodity. And I think Rebirth, this whole Captain America BS with Hydra, it's borne out again and again that all that matters is, you know, we no longer are interested in good story craft.
No.
We're more interested in making the money in the moment.
Well, speaking of making the money in the moment,
professional
podcasting, ladies and gentlemen, can you believe this show is still free? We are talking today about a story that went after I found this story, and we're going to be borrowing very heavily from an article that was on The Verge, TheVerge.com. The article goes under the name Texas Comic Book Heist. Anthony Chiafalo Tadano. If you search for that on The Verge's site, and we'll put a link up, you will be able to find all of the information and all of the research that we found. Because honestly, aside from a few like legal blogs, I could find no further information on this than what we found on The Verge. But this story is
this
amazing.
This is one of those fascinating comic tales. Not to, you know, toot my own horn too much, but. You know, one of the first articles I created for my own website after spinning the JCU off was Marvelution, the Shot Heard Around the Comic Industry. And when I tried to research the article, I discovered what I already knew well, and that is the internet is not the be-all, end-all. It's not the instant snap-your-fingers Library of Alexandria.
Right.
Because, quite frankly, the Library of Alexandria was not the most... was not a comprehensive repository of the knowledge of the ancients.
Right.
It was the single most consolidated, but it didn't mean everything anyone ever knew ever was written down on a scroll and put there. And like the Library of Alexandria, unless somebody puts it there, it ain't there.
Right.
And I was amazed that there was little to no information about Marvolution, so it's not surprising that some intrepid reporter or reporters dug deep into something that fascinated them and told the story based on what they could find.
I'm going to reach out to the team that wrote this story, and the team that wrote this story, Russell Brandom and Colin Letcher, and just to, I kind of want to interview the people who put this story together just to find out how they found the story and how.
Yes, indeed,
because the story's amazing. Like we're gonna go through it in stages, but the way that this plays out is like it's like a 2020 episode. It's like a 60 minutes. It's a
front line.
Yeah.
Not
it's
front line.
It's amazing.
A curious case of Anthony Chiafalo.
Now here's the thing about this guy. He's a douchebag, and I, you know, for all of the, and I'm not burying the lead. The thing about it is so far we've talked about, you know, litigation and literal art theft and you know, physical art theft and all of these different things, and this story just takes the damn cake. So
I think we pointed out at the beginning, and it bears repeating, that this was the story.
Yes.
This was the catalyst for this story arc. It's like Andy comes and says, okay, I've got this, let's build an arc around it.
Right, and it's worth it. So I'm going to start back at the beginning, and we're going to kind of work our way through this so everybody knows. So the story revolves around this guy. His name is Anthony
Chiafalo. And
let's point
out here, that, again, this is Hey Kids Comics number 181, The Curious Case of Anthony Chiafalo.
Yeah, he's good. God.
And he doesn't like de-age or anything, but he does digress, I think.
Mentally. Well, I think he mentally de-ages throughout the entirety. So this guy, and I'm going to start from the beginning. Now it's not until about the middle that the comic book pieces of this start getting put together, but you're going to start getting an idea for the man here.
Bear with us, because this does make a lot of sense as to why this was a Hey Kids Comics
right
feature.
So this guy's fall from grace, he was a lawyer, he was a pretty big up-and-comer. This guy's fall from grace, he ran for public office in the Bronx, ran as a Democrat in a largely Republican district, and got handily just curb stomped, essentially.
And I have to say, when reading the article from The Verge, I couldn't help but be struck by something that would not have been, you know, would not have struck the authors at the time because of when it was written, if I'm not mistaken, and that is the fact that that chapter of this man's life that they begin with, they lead with, all I could see was Wilson Fisk's dad.
yeah. No, that's absolutely. Imagine Wilson Fisk's dad.
I see Wilson Fisk's dad just lose. You know, it's all over. He's thrown all of his eggs into one basket, and apparently all of his marbles as well,
right.
Because this was, you know, that was the devastating point in his life, because he had, and as the article goes on, you begin to see why this had the effect that it had on him.
Right.
This was the very first gross illustration of his mental state.
Well, what happened was after he got, you know, his ass handed to him, he started really just disintegrating.
Think that they don't really touch on the article, but you get the impression from the way the story goes that the, you know, this defeat, it went beyond just, you know, not achieving this office that he was running for. I think I get the feeling, because of where he went afterward,
right,
that there was this sense in a deeply personal, you know, on a deeply personal level, that it was a done deal.
Well, there's a psychopathology.
There was a part of him that couldn't accept
that
there was any outcome other than victory.
Right. And when he didn't get victory, he started basically, you know, chasing ghosts in every corner, became very, very paranoid. His wife filed for, and he had two kids, and his wife filed for divorce and filed, orders of protection and, orders to keep him away from the kids, which Chiafalo broke handily in a very short amount of time.
Yeah, and this is the sort of thing with these types of personalities where you have a married person. It seems that inevitably,
mm-hmm.
you know, one loss following another, then everything becomes an affront, that the world is out to get them, and suddenly the you know, none of this should be happening.
Because well, this isn't his script. He started making a script. He started writing notes to his wife that were by court, you know, by court report, hostile, obscene, and derogatory, to his wife, to his children's guardian, and then to the clerk of the court presiding over his divorce case.
And, you know, as a lawyer, all of a sudden he's like, you know, he'd gone from Wilson Fisk's dad to, you know, the most exaggerated form of Saul Goodman.
Right. The most asinine form of Saul Goodman. Because, you know, Saul Goodman at least had the common sense to not pull this, to not pull the next thing he did, which was sue his wife and 30 other people that were involved in the court case, saying that they had infringed on his civil rights. Because here's the thing about lawyers.
Yeah.
I can say this with honesty and assurity because, number one, my brother went to law school, went to pre-law, went to law, graduated, is a brilliant lawyer and a very smart and kind guy. But if you ever get into an argument with a lawyer, you are, let alone the fact that you're related to one, you are wrong. You are always wrong. You are going to be wrong. And you are an affront to whatever point he's trying to make in stating that possibly he could be, you know, trying to find common ground will not happen. So, yeah, the... by 2008, now that was 2004, so by 2008, based on all the frivolous lawsuits, based on all the letters he wrote, they filed for disbarment. And, Cole, would you like to read the quotes from the court on the disbarment? Because I know you really like them.
There are some wonderful things that were quoted here in the article. Trends of grandiosity and impulsivity and poor judgment.
Right.
Also stating that he would regress at times of stress and duress, particularly around financial, legal, and family issues. And finally goes on to say things like, when he did, his narcissistic defenses came to the fore, often to his detriment. And I love the more simplified non-legal brief version.
The TLDR, yeah.
Yeah, someone involved in the case, one of the targets of his many lawsuits, he's a whack job, bad news.
Just bad news.
Hey, he's a bad news, you know? We used to get guys like that in my neighborhood, you know?
See, that's the thing.
He's got a little crazy in the head. You just, like, you walk away. You go down the other side of the street. It's okay. It doesn't mean you're not a man, but just...
I mean, he's a man. He's just a guy, you know? We called him Joey Roast Beef in the neighborhood. He liked a meatball sandwich occasionally. He'd come around. You know, sometimes we'd have to get a little rough with him. Sometimes, you know, we'd have to dust off our knuckles on his jawbones, but... You know, it was all right. I don't know what happened here. Maybe I hit him in the head with a brick. I'm not saying I did. Just saying it could have happened. Could have hit him in the head with a brick. Made this happen. I don't know.
That may or may not have been me.
I'm glad Angelo's back.
Angelo is back.
Brother. Angelo is back, baby. Angelo, my favorite character that we have developed in the last year for Hey Kids Comics, makes an expected return in the story of a Bronx guy losing his mind.
That's the way it is in the Bronx, you know. Some of us can handle it. Some of us can't handle it.
So this crazy guy goes off the rails, and if we're to extrapolate what happens next, I really think that we kind of delve into a psychopathy, but more like a sociopathology, because he ends up hooking up with his high school sweetheart, who lives in, of all places, a suburb in Houston, Texas, Cole's backyard.
Yeah, she lived down in Spring, Texas, apparently. I guess she got out of the Bronx. What's the matter?
Let's just get out. You can take the Bronx out of the... You could take Tony.
You can take the girl out of the Bronx, but you can't take the Bronx out of the girl.
You could take Tony out of the Bronx.
I put it there, Angelo.
Damn it, Angelo. Get back here. It's your hand, Angelo. How many pretzels you going in? All in. Angelo's all in. But yeah, so he moves to Spring, Texas. He convinces his high school sweetheart to take him back after all of this. So
yeah, I guess she must not have been voting in that district. Or I guess, you know, she's living down in the spring. Maybe she comes back to the Bronx on vacation or something, check out the old neighborhood. You know, by then, all of the signs have been burned in a giant bonfire, and the bonfire of the vanity, if you will. And that he, you know, she probably was none the wiser coming in. And a lot of times, very strong psychological personalities like this tend to fare best when you don't, you know, it's like the Mandarin, you never see me coming.
Right, right. Yeah, you leave your past like, behind,
never
you never
see
mention
me coming.
Except for the problem with Angelo. Angelo, you always see Angelo coming because he's got that sack full of oranges that he just carries around and whacks people in the face with. Hey, don't leave a bruise, I'm just saying.
Sometimes it's a sack, sometimes it's a sock, whatever I have at hand.
Whatever I got on hand. You know,
for nice fringe.
old pair of boxer briefs that I sewed the ends up on. I put old locks in there.
It's an orange carrier, Your Honor.
That's right. So he moves to Texas, gets a job with a place called, I'm not going to do the name justice.
But apologies to this corporation.
Yeah, Tadano, I think. It's a Japanese company that makes cranes, essentially. Is going to start.
Talking about the heavy lifting type, not the paper.
Yeah.
Blade Runner type.
Or the ones that are in the doorways of Applebee's. These are the real cranes.
Oh, yes, indeed.
But at the same time as he gets this job and he gets, you know, a nice big fat salary, a disciplinary committee, he was trying to lobby for to keep his New York law license.
Yeah.
Saying that he had sought psychiatric help, which there are no records that he did that, but he was suspended from practicing law in New York.
I would imagine perhaps he thought that if you look it up in the phone book, you know,
right,
look under S for psychiatrist, that, you know, that's enough. That is seeking psychiatric help.
So his job at Tadano was to start working with other companies to start selling these cranes, to coordinate with other local firms all over the world.
Basically he was one of those in a corporation like that that's just all over the place.
Right.
They have to have a lot of people that are, you know, that they're there to coordinate the fact that all these companies are working with so many other companies, both their clientele and other companies doing legal stuff, doing manufacturing stuff, doing all these disparate things. There's so much there.
Right.
That there's a certain level at which a lot of hanky-panky goes on in cases like this because it's impossible. You can't micromanage all this.
But the thing is, they noticed this giant spike in legal fees.
Yeah,
coming out of Chiafalo,
especially once he was in Texas.
right. So they got suspicious and they started looking into it. They started trying to trace the money back, they found a bill for a place called Schneider and Verdone LLP, which was located, oddly enough, in this, you know, at the same address that he lives. Which is dumb. It's a company that only... We find out later it's a company that only existed in New York. It was a firm that Chiafalo retained to work on his divorce proceedings. So they find a bill from the company that Chiafalo had on retainer to handle his divorce proceedings. He did that.
What's amazing, though, is there's this bill from this company in New York.
Right.
But the payment of said bill... the billing address,
yes,
just happens to be in Spring, Texas.
Right, shocking, right?
Where he lives with his new bride.
No.
Yeah, they apparently opened a non-existent branch there,
and they found bills that for places that didn't even exist, come for law firms that don't exist at all. So essentially, what happened was. Chiafalo built this structure, this weird kind of labyrinth of transferring money and paying people that don't exist and taking t- basically taking and embezzling a ton of money.
Absolutely.
From Tom
Donahue. This is a really good case in point of the way this sort of thing happens. It's like, I remember when I was in high school or something, there was some report of somebody had figured out an algorithm to just shear off, you know, round off all of these giant transactions that were ending in a penny or two.
Right.
Just round them all off.
Nobody misses a penny.
Yeah, and shunt all those individuals. Yeah, exactly. Even fractions of pennies. And shunt all that off into, you know, into the a special account. And, you know, it doesn't sound like a whole lot of money. You know, at first blush, you're thinking, well, you could probably get upwards of $110 that way. But the level of transactions being made, he was making millions.
Right, right.
And was, you know, this was continuing to go on there. And then you had the same sort of idea with Chiafalo is there's so much money changing hands so often that it takes just pure chance often that somebody raises an eyebrow about something somewhere.
And it's so, and the legal aspects are so obtuse that the casual observer would never be able to, you know, look at it through whatever prism they're looking at it through and figure out what's going on. So
yeah, it takes then an action, a concerted action to go digging.
Which is what they did. They went in and they looked at everything, they added everything up, they compiled, summed it all up, came to just about $9 million on Chiafalo's watch that had disappeared. So they started the investigation, they figured it out, they went to Chiafalo and they said, you know, they presented the habeas corpus to his ass. They presented the body, said, this is what we know happened. Where's
all
this money?
I think where they wound up erring here was from the looks of things in the article, it sounds like someone took it upon themselves to confront him on this.
Right.
And he goes so far as to, you know, claim a partnership with a non-existent lawyer.
Yeah, yeah.
Whose entire, you know, everything about this lawyer is completely, it's cobbled together from the resume of an existing lawyer with a picture of a different lawyer. And, you know, it's like he doesn't even understand that, you know, his fantasy holds water like a sieve.
Well, but the thing is, so when they presented him with that, and they kind of figured it out. Well, first of all, like you said, he claimed that he knew this that he was working with this super lawyer, that he had all these records which are completely doctored, falsified. None of them were real. And then as soon as he figured out that the jig was up, that the cops were onto him, essentially, he mowed out. He was like, whoop, 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 whoop. He cheesed it. He was gone. They couldn't find him. He was in the wind.
And meanwhile, his wife, who I guess at this point had kind of fallen under this spell of, you know, I think she had bought into the fantasy so wholeheartedly that, you know, when they come looking for him, she's like, oh, I haven't seen him in months, and, you know, I don't even know anything about what's going on here.
So what do you do? Here's the question. What do you do when you have $9 million of embezzled money that you need to hide? What do you do as a normal human being?
Yeah, that's the thing. I think all of us are hard-pressed. I think most people would be hard-pressed to figure out how does one launder money, but you know, even the completely non-nefarious among us, those of us who would never consider even coming close to anything like this, you know, or you know, even though we know at least enough to know that we, you know, this is not the approach he took to laundering this money, to trying to disappear all these ill-gotten funds. Makes about as much sense as some of the rest of his fantasy land.
Right.
And that approach, the approach in question here, is that for some reason, I guess known only to him, he goes on a massive spending spree. What do you do with this $9 million you've managed to scrape into your lap? Well, apparently, if you're this guy, you go off and just start buying up all kinds of collectibles at random. And And the reason we know this is that two things happened. During the investigation, somebody tipped off the cops that his wife was about to go on a lam to New York.
Okay.
When she was claiming she'd never heard from him at all. Oh, but she also had
a one-way ticket back to
old New York the next day. And then also, some connections were beginning to be made with Chiafalo and a local storage facility. So, essentially, the warrants were issued. And what they found in his name is...
This is it, guys. This is the payoff right here.
Now, this is what you've been waiting for. 7 distinct climate-controlled units in his name. And I don't know if you've ever rented a climate-controlled unit of any size. Those babies ain't cheap.
No, they're not. And 7 of them.
It doesn't sound like he was using the little ones, you know, those little closets with air conditioning.
Yeah.
This was 7 units. Unit 1 was crammed full of sports memorabilia, trading cards, autographed helmets and the like. Unit 2, it's like you turn into the collector.
Exactly. I have theories about this, but go on.
It's like some sort of Bronxy version of the collector from the...
I think Benicio del Toro was the Bronxy version. Just imagine him as Benicio del Toro as the collector. I think you're pretty much dead on.
So then, you know, the next one is a kind of a setup as a study almost. Apparently had furniture and...
I picture it like the Masterpiece Theater set.
It's like Alistair Cook's actual set there. And it strikes me as maybe this was where after he crammed the other first one full of sports memorabilia, he started like buying memorabilia books or something perhaps. And this was the office where he sat, plotted what to go after next.
Memorabilia.
Yeah, the third unit had apparently a bunch of framed Texas flags and tons of photos of celebrities and historical figures, including inexplicably Mussolini.
He had a mat on for Mussolini, this guy.
I don't know what that was all about. I guess he kept the trains of collectibles running on time.
Right. He really looked up to the guy's business acumen, apparently.
Apparently, yeah. It was just chock full of memorabilia and collectibles. A fourth unit was full of figurines of sports and celebrity
photos and autographs.
Photos and paintings.
God, this guy.
And the next one was crammed full of baseball cards and more photos, including apparently more photos of Mussolini.
More Mussolini photos.
The sixth unit was full of statuary of superheroes and all kinds of other memorabilia. And then in the seventh unit.
First of all, the units 1 through 6, if I had $9 million, if you swapped out pictures of Prince with pictures of Mussolini, I'm pretty sure mine would be...
This is what your version of the... If you went mad and and did this, that's what...
I imagine that he thought of this like as his weird Ahab submarine from League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Either that or he maybe saw Kingdom of the Crystal Skull.
Oh, no. Well, that would drive anyone mad.
Yeah, and then he just became like, you know, his knowledge was power.
So what was in the seventh unit, Cole?
The seventh unit, you can imagine them, you know, clipping the lock off and opening this thing up. The overhead rattles up and, hey, kids, comics!
Tits over tea kettles full of comics, really.
Yeah, it's just nearly 50 boxes of comics. And we're not talking about just... Okay, there were things that were described as being, you know, maybe worth a dollar, if that.
Right.
You can imagine your dollar bin crap intermingled with super high-end, like, you know, early action comics and...
Batman 2.
Yeah.
Young Allies 1.
Things that most of us will never see, much less own.
Action Comics 1 was
in
there.
And one of the other things that was interesting in this case as they were doing their digging was they found that they had there were a lot of transactions between Schiaffalo and a company in Texas called Heritage Auctions.
Right.
And Heritage Auctions, famously, amongst other things, was had brought up the or were the they were the ones who auctioned Nick Cage's collection.
Right.
When he got disgruntled with comics and after the big theft that we talked about earlier in this arc. So this is becomes a very unique twist in everything, because as that begins to be explored, they have to figure out, they know by this time, because then they search the house as well. They get a search warrant for the house because they get a tip that the wife's going to take off. The wife who claims to know nothing about his activities.
Right.
The entire house is like a microcosm of these seven storage units. It's crammed top to bottom.
They refer to it as the museum. It's got enough in there that they call it the museum.
So it is just chock full of stuff.
So let me ask this. Go ahead and finish up, and then I've got some questions for you. Yeah,
absolutely. So, you know, they really begin to take a serious look at it. And I think at this point, Schiaffalo's just kind of, he's in the wind.
Oh yeah, he's gone. He's gone at this point.
Now they're confronted with trying to figure out what he might have taken with him. And because a lot of these comics are the types of things, it's described in the article as being like a, you know, stealing a museum painting. There's not a lot of people that deal in that sort of thing.
No.
You can't just take it to anybody and sell it off. And because, you know, we live in an electronic age, every aspect of these high-end, you know, what few specimens remained have been cataloged in meticulous detail, much like if you were, you know, digging canopic urns at Symbol, you know, you would catalog every crack, every nook, every pockmark.
Right.
And we do that very much the same way, only electronically these days.
Well, so my question to you then is, so the cops kind of put two and two together. They start looking into Heritage Auction House. They start seeing that that these comics were bought. They kind of trace them back to Schiaffalo, right?
Yeah.
Why would he... Okay, so like I was saying at the top of this section, a sane man, offshore account, you know, mafia, he's from the Bronx. He's a friend of Angelo. He probably could find a connection to... That's my new term for the mafia, by the way, friend of Angelo.
Friend of Angelo.
He probably could have found a way to actually launder this money illegally, like straight up illegally, you know?
Yeah.
Why do you think he turned to buying memorabilia, buying a shit ton of real expensive comics and signed Pete Rose helmets and various, you know, Mussolini's underpants and whatever else he bought? Why do you think that he chose this route versus one of the kind of more standard, you know, CSI New York routes of laundering money?
I think it really comes down to his state of mind. I think at this point, there must have been something about him that was that, you know, that collector bug had hit. Maybe when the money started coming in, he started buying a few things that he wouldn't normally be able to afford. And then just looking at the nature of this collection, psychologically what I'm seeing, and I'm just sort of an armchair psychologist, but I think that the underlying psychology that's suggested anyway is that of a collector slash hoarder. That he, you know, gets the collector bug and then just keeps jumping from collectible to collectible as he begins to move in collector circles. And I see this sort of thing as, you know, historical photos. Yeah, let me get in on that. Oh, sports memorabilia, that's cool. What, comics? There's money in that?
Well, and that's the thing is, you know, I kind of see it as whatever, if he had accomplices or if they're just people that he knew through conversation, like, man, you know, sitting at a bar doing something. Hey, if you had $9 million, let's just 8.74 million dollars. You know, what do you think you could put that, you know, you could put that in and never get caught, and it would give me a return on my investment. And some nerd that he was with was like, well, you know, comics. comics is where it's at. Like, you know, I'm going to put my kids through college on the comics that I have.
Or even the value notwithstanding, the way that this stuff was just sort of all thrown together in storage unit after storage unit after storage unit, and this sort of progression. It's almost like a roadmap.
Right.
Assuming that these were opened in the order that they were obtained, which it may well have been, because the description certainly bears that out, where you have your first storage unit is chock full of a certain kind of collectibles, you know, a couple of different genres, and then your second one is this office, this sort of makeshift office, and that's where I think you're really seeing this thing turning into something bigger. And that's why I classify it as almost like a collector hoarder.
I can
because
see that.
I'm wondering if there was even any inkling of value in this
as far as what he thought.
Yeah, within the psychosis, if it was more that it was about being able to collect what others can't. You know, suddenly he's positioned to be this super collector that, regardless of what collecting circles he moves in.
Well, you know, the I think a couple of the really telling things are that when he bought this stuff from Heritage Auction House, when he purchased it, kind of, there was no research involved. There was no, am I getting this for a good price? There was just willy-nilly spending. You know, he would buy things that were, you know, thousands of dollars over what you could get them at book price for, you know, at market price.
Oh, yeah. In fact, one of the things the article mentions is one of the big red flags in the entire case was this record-breaking price that he paid for one of these rare comics.
It was All-Star 3, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right. And it was beyond anything anyone had ever paid for one. Even better specimens had never fetched this price.
Right.
Yet, you know, the auction went through, the money was paid, everybody had what they wanted.
Also, these comics, when the cops went into, you know, because what they did was they went in and they saw this stuff and they realized, hey, we're kind of out of our league here. So they started talking to some professionals, you know, whether it be comic shop owners or big collectors or the auction houses themselves. The comics that they had weren't slabbed. And we're talking comics like All-Star 3, we're talking Batman 2, we're talking the weird comic from the state fair that weren't slabbed. These were these were hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of comics that no one was going to read. They were literally, like, I completely support, if you have a copy of Amazing Spider-Man number 3, slab that shit.
Yeah, this story really did change my tune on the slabbing. I think that it's grossly overused, but in the case of certain books that are worth thousands of dollars, I think it's worthwhile, because the article spoke of the purpose that serves, because, like I was talking earlier, you know, when you're at an archaeological dig, everything is so intricately chronicled. Every last little crease and any bit of foxing around the cover or interior, any kind of anything, is meticulously chronicled so that when these books do come on the market, it can be researched. Did they change hands legally? Is this the book? And, you know, is somebody trying to buy a $100,000 comic, you know, or $10,000 comic book and put a counterfeit in its place and then sell it for like $5,000?
Right.
And then we go look at the counterfeit, and you're like, well, this is a copy of that book, but it doesn't have the exact same creases that were chronicled. And that's rather how the next interesting twist in this amazing tale, Chiafalo almost becomes secondary to the story.
This is the most important. For me, this is the most interesting part of the story. But before we get to that, some of you might have questions, like Cole and I did, about how he would go about spending this money at Heritage Auction House the way that he did, and how they go about...
How does that system work? Because
right.
I'm fortunate to know a couple of people who work for Heritage.
And we were fortunate enough to have one Thomas Branch, who does work for Heritage, on the show recently, and he sat down with us and gave us a short interview explaining how the Heritage Auction House works. So we're going to let Thomas take it from here, and we'll join you on the other side to
That's
finish
right.
we'll out this
We'll point
tale.
Out that he was not working for them at the time of this transaction.
No, and no blame gets put on the Heritage Auction House for anything that happened here. They are simply a broker.
In the case of what the transactions that they made, what's interesting here is the properties sold were all sold legally.
Correct.
They were just purchased with bad money, with dirty money. So it's a fascinating little twist there. But yes, listen to what Thomas has to say as we talk to him about the mysteries of how heritage auctions work and, you know, how these high-end auctions come about. And then we'll be back with the next fascinating twist in this serpentine tale.
More than anything, the idea would be just how it works, so that people understand. Like, because I don't.
Say
even...
for example, I have one of your prints, and I wanted to try to sell it for a lot more than I paid for it, just to see how stupid people are.
Or let's say I want one of your prints, and I'm willing to spend a lot more money than the market feels it's worth. Like, how does that work? Like that's just how does it work? Like, because I have no idea. Like, you know, I know it exists, and I know that you do stuff, but I have no idea, like, how the mechanisms that make it run. You know, like I don't understand all the moving parts.
Well, it's fairly simple. I mean, certain departments have two types of sales. One's a weekly sale, and one's a signature sale. The signature sale is usually the big stuff, all the really hard to find things, the really unique things or spotlighted things. Now, Heritage sells like all types of crazy ass shit. So, and you can quote me on that. So we do.
Because I noticed that they're departments. You know, there's like an armor department.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, we do weapon. We have weapons. We do wine. We do real estate. We're thinking about doing vintage cars soon. Comics, sports, books, guitars. What else? Coins. Coins is obviously 60% of our business.
Really?
Well, the company was started with two coin companies.
Oh.
Two coin companies became one company, and then it dominates everything that we do. So, I mean, that's a big deal. All right. Coins. Ooh, they're all asses.
Wouldn't they be more like tails?
They're like the popular kids.
Yeah, so if you've got 60% share, you kind of wind up that way.
So let's say I have the first appearance of Deadpool, and I want to put it up in your auction house to sell. How do I go about doing that?
I will tell you that you need at least $5,000 worth of stuff before we even start talking to you.
Okay, you won't get out
That's
of bed.
No, because I had a non-hypothetical, and I don't think that my non-hypothetical comes close. I've got a really nice unpunched, God's truth, an unpunched, probably 1950s, possibly older, staple bound Captain Marvel family glider set.
Nice.
That you would punch out the gliders and build them. And
sure.
And but I don't think I'm coming close to hitting that 5K mark, and I don't think I have. If I have 5K worth of stuff in everything in the garage, a lot of it is probably not the sort of thing that Heritage is known for.
Okay. Well. Okay. So let's say I have something that is. Oh, go ahead. Yeah, I'm sorry. So let's say I have something that is $5,000 worth, right? How do you determine that, and then how does it go from my stuff to the stuff that ends up on in your auction house?
Okay, so you'll send a photo in or explain it to the department that you're submitting it to. So say that you have Action Comics #1, And then you tell the people at Heritage and Comics that you have this. They'll ask for a photo of it. They'll ask you if it's been slabbed or not, CGC'd, or what the condition is. They'll most likely, because it's such a high priced item, they'll ask you if you're in Dallas, if you can come to Dallas. Now Heritage has people in New York and Chicago and Houston and Hollywood. And so if you're in New York, you could go to our New York office, and we have a comic expert there, because we also have one of our auction houses is there. From there, it just turns into a lot of guesstimating how much it is, what we estimate it as, and then there's a contract made where we get, Heritage gets 16% to 20% of the final hammer price. So if it goes for $1 million, we get up to, say, 20% of that is ours for us selling it to you and promoting it, because obviously it's a high price thing. We're going to promote the shit out of it, and
you're also offering the kind of audience that a lay seller does not have at their disposal.
Yeah, exactly. And then most likely, most of our big signature sales for comics is usually in New York. So we would go to the New York office. It's a big to-do. There's a couple hundred people there. There's about 10 to 20 phone bidders that take online. There's online bidding that you can do if you're not able to go into Houston or New York. So you can bet online, you can bet email or through the internet, or you can actually be there, do the old raise a little paddle thing.
Wow, I want to do that one day.
And then it goes, and it's usually like increments. Once you hit a platform, it gets more money. So if it starts off at like $100, then it's like in $10 increments. Once you get to $500, it turns into $20 increments. Once you get to $1,000, it turns into $50 increments, so forth and so on.
Yeah, otherwise you're there for a month.
Yeah, you're there freaking forever. Now, I've only seen $1 million sale once. And $1 million is like $25,000.
Wow.
For the next jump. So yeah, I mean, it gets pretty crazy stuff. As an employee of Heritage, I am, or at least my department, I am required to attend the three signature sales that my department does and do phone bidding. So I get to control someone's,
Okay, so you're like someone that you're assigned, or someone's assigned to you, and you're
right.
You're
I call somebody.
You're the one raising the paddle for them via the phone.
Right. So you're on the phone. You're just like, okay, so it's at $7,000 now. Would you like to bid $700, $7,100?
And the thing about it is, sure. if I wound up with you, not just like anyone else, but like you.
In life? Partner in life?
The person that I was bidding on the phone, and I got Thomas assigned to me. It would be like, the way you put that, I was ready to bid higher. Even if I didn't have the money, I would find it. Like, you're just like, well, if you'd like to.
The ultimate salesman.
Yeah, why wouldn't I, It's just,
And that's the thing is that before the...
So I hope they recognize how lucky they are to have you, because you probably
draw God.
People's sales.
Could you get a room called
passively persuasive there?
Well, and these sales start or go online. They're activated a month before the sale starts. So those starting prices that we, opening bids, stuff like this, they'll go all the way to the day of the sale, and some stuff goes through the roof. So something that we originally estimated at, say, $2,000 may have like $7,000 into it already by the time we get to the sale.
That's amazing, because the dynamic, the behind the scenes of how that sort of thing works was something that I don't think most of us would have even thought about.
So, in terms of this story, what we're looking at is a guy who laundered a bunch of money, and then in order to further launder it so he wouldn't get caught, bought a bunch of comic books. Is there any kind of restriction on what people spend? Does anything raise a red flag? Not that this would, but you know, is there any kind of structure in place for that, or is it just pretty much market value is market value?
I think it's mostly market value is market value. Now, don't get me wrong. We have people in place to you know, there's a huge vetting, you know,
sure,
for bidders and stuff like this. It's like, you sure you can cover this? You know, what about this? I mean, it's all built into contracts and whatnot.
Yeah,
and
you don't want somebody in there driving the bid up and then, like, it's just some guy on a payphone.
Right.
Well, yeah.
I mean, we sold a few months ago the only known Frankenstein 3-sheet. Fully restored. It was in some cat's closet. His dad owned a theater, and he put it in his closet and chewed the shit out of it, like cut the eyes out of Frankenstein's face.
What?
And, you know, kids are kids. And we spent, and I like telling the story, is that we spent, like, almost 10 grand to restore it. I mean, that's how badly it was built, and it went for $400,000.
Good night.
When it was all said and done, and the person who lost it, now not the winner, the person who lost it was Kurt Hammond of Metallica.
Really? Oh. Really?
Because he has a massive horror collection.
God. I could sit here and ask questions about this for a million years. I just want you to understand that for
if this was Hey Kids Auctions,
oh my God, I would
we would be all over this thing.
Oh my God.
Our last auction, I did phone bidding for Brett Ratner.
What?
That guy was a huge dick.
So there's no, I mean, I think when we think of auctions, like real honest to God auctions, if you've ever been to like a charity art auction at a convention or an auction, like a real auction, we know if you haven't been to one, most of what we've seen is on TV, you know, and it's a bunch of guys in like petticoats and diamond bracelets raising a paddle. But what you're saying is even in the auction world, there's no accounting for taste when it comes to the people either bidding or the things being bid on.
So true.
Okay. So once somebody wins something, how do they then get what they want?
Then we expect payment between so amount of time and this amount of time. This is the opportunity where if they decide to have cold feet, they can pull out before paying. But normally most people are pretty committed to it.
Does it just go back onto another auction later, or how does that pan out?
Sometimes yes. Sometimes we'll reach out to the second and say, do you still want this item type situation. I've never been told if that's ever worked before. I'm not that high up in the art.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say if that Frankenstein winner balks, chances are Metallica guy's going to go for it.
Cole's got a cool $300 that he'll give you for that. American. None of that Metallica money they're printing in the basement over there. This is real American money.
The kind we've been using for thousands of years.
Thousands of years.
I'll give you 4 goats and wheat.
So this guy goes in, spends way over market value, buys a bunch of comics with this money he embezzled, and then hides these things in what they call the museum, which is essentially just a bunch of storage units. Have you ever heard of anything else like this happening?
The only thing else I can that I've heard was, which recently happened again at Heritage, is we were going to sell this amazing Kurt Swan piece. Kurt Swan piece, Superman piece. It was priced to go for a lot of money, and then Kurt Swan's estate said that was stolen.
Really?
And because it was given to DC Comics by Kurt Swan, and somewhere during one of the office shifts, it made it into someone's car instead.
Wow.
It completely disappeared for years. Apparently it was gone for a while. And then it just resurfaces.
That's remarkable.
Right.
That's insane.
Yeah, so we started this huge marketing deal, and then this came out, and we're like, okay, we're going to pull this.
Yeah. That's nuts.
It's not ours.
I'm like, burning my fingers.
Oh, man. Well, Thomas, thank you so much for joining us once again to shed light on a real kind of sticky situation. We appreciate it. I think now we understand the machinations a little better of how this works. So this story will continue further. It's pretty nuts. Thank you, Thomas.
Sure, no problem.
There you go. Perfect.
Yes.
That was exactly what we needed. You are a machine, sir.
Yeah.
You're a monster. I love it. I'm just going to call you into every episode at some point and be like, Galactus, and go for 5 minutes. You got five minutes to filibuster Galactus. Oh, man.
He's hungry. He's misunderstood.
He's just hungry and misunderstood.
He's got a cosmic sized tapeworm. He's got to keep on eating.
Yeah.
He's got a cosmic sized tapeworm.
I think it's kind of a cautionary tale.
It is.
I'm not really sure.
He's just trying to be on The Biggest Loser, and he can't. Yeah. He's not big.
I mean, he's literally the biggest loser. Like.
Well, I hate to tell you this now, but according to Marvel Comics, he no longer.
He's not a bad guy.
That. Well, no. He's part of the Ultimates now, but he doesn't hunger for planets anymore.
Right. He hungers for goodness.
Now he only eats stars.
Well, I mean, he got to eat something.
He only eats guitars.
Yeah, there was a song about it.
Damn it.
He was eating bars for a while there, but.
Shit. All right. Cash it out. Thanks, Thomas. You're awesome.
Thank you very much.
Sure, no problem.
All right.
Bye, buddy. So there you go. Thank you, Thomas,
thank you very much for joining us.
For joining us and giving us some insight there. Now we get into what I think might be the strangest part of this tale.
And before we delve too deeply in, I want to say here mid-show, I want to say hello to my older brother, Clay.
Okay.
This will make sense to Clay. And now we'll move on.
Okay. Hi, Clay. When they were going through this, they went into these storage lockers and just went through with a fine-tooth comb, logging every comic book, every piece of memorabilia into evidence. Sometimes they got sick of it and just logged it as one, you know, one lump sum, one lot.
It was often described as being, you know, a box of 300 comics.
So now we get into the side story of a man named Lonnie Blevins. Lonnie Blevins was a district attorney investigator for Harris County, where this story takes place. So Lonnie,
it should be pointed out that he is an investigator of some tenure.
Right, he'd been around for a while. So in 2012, August 11th, which is right after my birthday, I need to make it back to this particular show, which is the Wizard World Chicago Comic Convention. Lonnie walks in with a box of comic books. Now, Lonnie had worked on this case.
Yep.
Some of these comics apparently didn't make it from the storage unit museum back to the district attorney's office. They had gone missing. So
yes, in fact, but no one realized this until Lonnie goes off to Chicago, because it is at conventions like Wizard World where your guys with the giant wads of $100 bills
right.
conduct the transactions. The guys who move $5,000, $10,000 comics between one another and between themselves and collectors, there are a handful of people that do this so routinely that it would be like your corner comic shop buying a, like, say, a Spawn number one to add to their wall.
Right, right.
So he comes in with these comics, and this is where the grading, the slabbing of these comics.
Yeah, really remember that All-Star number three we were talking about before that goes for about 200 grand?
Yeah, so he's coming in trying to peddle these books, and the less shrewd among the buyers are, I guess, we're seeing dollar signs.
Well, and the thing, what you don't do, what you ever don't do, is try, in our community, especially in books like this, we know, we follow comic book stats the way that football players follow football stats, and the way that the baseball fans follow baseball stats. We know when a two or $300,000 book sells. We do. We see it. It's on the yeah. news sites. It's on Newsarama. It's on The Verge. It's, you know, we know that kind of thing. So if you walk into a comic book convention with just a banana box full of loose comics worth upwards of $500,000, you're going to raise some suspicion.
Yeah, and I think that it took some shrewd comic dealers to realize that these are, here were some books that were being put forth that you don't normally see guys just walk in. And I think it was I don't recall if there was even a story behind them. He was just going around peddling these things.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the only story that he had was the fact that he needed to accept checks and cash. If it wasn't cash, he needed to accept checks for under 10 grand because he was going through a divorce and he didn't want his wife. And that's the reason that he was selling his comics, was to pay for his divorce, and he didn't want his wife finding out so that she would take more of his money, because that would, anything over 10 grand would flag, is what he was telling people. But yeah, so all these comics unslabbed that matched the description of comics that were sold, that were slabbed and were sold on through the Heritage Auction House, were now showing up at this convention in the hands of this investigator for the district attorney that worked on this case. So,
exactly. And a lot of it was sold.
Yes. Yeah, because that's the thing, is it's hard to pass up a book like that selling for half of its value. It's real hard.
Yeah.
I can tell you, it's real hard.
And it turned out that as the investigations were going the other way, more than $150,000 worth of comics had just sort of disappeared into the ether about the same time this guy was going around peddling them at shows.
Well, so this guy makes off of these comics to sell at these shows, right? We later find out that these comics were stolen under the auspices of the district attorney, a guy named Deutsch, worked with Harris to steal these comics. And then
kind of helped fudge the books a little bit there.
And then go through a labyrinthine mislabeling process to make sure that nobody knew what these comics were, and as far as they were labeled into evidence and things like that, so that he could make off with them, sell them, and eventually split the money with Deutsch, the district attorney in the case.
Exactly. Yeah, he was going to be the one to go and, Deutsch made it, facilitated, he was going to be the one, you're flying, I'm buying type of thing.
Right, right. So, yeah, so eventually that gets found out, and both of them are summarily fired.
And you have to imagine that, in a little town like Spring, an ambitious souls might see some serious dollar signs that they can just sort of produce on the fly. And who would be any the wiser with that volume of stuff? And they're the ones in charge of cataloging it.
And the thing was that Chicago wasn't the only convention that this guy went to. He went literally, because, he's from Texas. He went across country selling these books.
Yeah.
That he made off. These are comic books.
And also, here are officers of the court You know, I hate the term "you ought to know better," but you ought to know better!
But the thing that amazes me the most about this story, okay, is that we're not talking about, you know, blood diamonds. We're not talking about, like, this isn't,
from the stash of guns or a couple of kilos off the top.
These are comic books. These are the things that, you know, I have four long boxes behind me. Nothing that comes close to what we're talking about here. But I have four boxes of comic books behind me, and this guy is. These are comic books that these guys are risking everything for.
I think this is a case of a little knowledge is a dangerous thing, because what they had the knowledge of was the value, the potential value of these comics, and they had the knowledge of how to move them, where to go to find the buyer for these comics that you wouldn't normally find a buyer for without, you know, going through Heritage Auctions and making it bloody obvious. So, and to try to make it look like it was from their own personal collection, they unslabbed books.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, when people started to investigate those books, they discovered, oh, look, here's a record of this being slabbed. Who in their right mind would take it out of the slab? Nobody.
Right.
So it's an interesting case. Like I said, you know, it goes on to talk about Chiafalo's fate and him being found in Rhode Island, I think it was, with a suitcase full of money.
In
this way that, you know, something you'd expect out of a movie. But he becomes a secondary character, because the real story then becomes how his crime then begets yet another crime.
Right. It's almost a weird Stephen King short story, Monkey's Paw. You know, or even more than that, it becomes like a Dan Brown like novel at that point. You know, like, you've got these things. The thing that amazed me about this is that you don't hear comics used in this way.
Yeah, it's not like, you know, where you're smuggling the Kruger ends.
Right. The Hope Diamond is not involved in this story.
Yeah, and it's fascinating that it was comics that were driving this tale. That if this were a Hollywood movie, you know, you would have to have, like you said, diamonds or...
I don't know, I think Wes Anderson could pull this off.
He probably could. Actually, this has all the makings thereof.
Yeah, Bill Murray could be in it.
Bill Murray would be in it. That's Wes Anderson. That's a given.
I mean, right. You know,
if Wes Anderson did the... a movie about the kid destroying the Lego sculpture, Bill Murray would be in it, just sort of reprising his role from Lost in Translation. I mean, just there'd be something.
Right.
No, that's not a Wes Anderson movie. I just still be in Asia.
Luke and who's his brother? Luke and the other Owens brother would definitely be Chiafalo and. Luke and Weird Nosed Other Brother, blonde guy. They were definitely
Weird Nosed Other Brother.
Weird Nosed Other Brother. But yeah, no, that's the thing that really struck me about this as I read it, was that it wasn't. We aren't talking about, you know, we aren't talking about a Monet. We aren't talking about a Picasso. We aren't talking about the Hope Diamonds. We aren't talking about the, you know, a story, you know, about the crown jewels. We're talking about comic books. And we don't, as comic book fans, consider, and that's probably the other part that's the most interesting thing to me, is that we don't consider comics to, we know that they can be valuable. We've had shows about how people think they're going to put their kids through college on comics. But as real comic book fans, the value is secondary to the emotional attachment that comics give you. So seeing this story on paper or digitally, however you saw it, really struck a chord with me that people believe this. This is an actual, you know, paradigm that people live in, that comics are worth so much that they're willing to give up everything, use them to launder money, then steal them to, you know, at grand larceny.
Yeah, it almost goes like Nacho, you know, where you're stealing from the criminals because they have no recourse.
Right. So, man, this story. But how does it end up? Do we know? I know they catch him.
Yeah, they did ultimately catch him on, you know, massive grand larceny charges, and I think the two good old boys in Texas were, you know, naturally also captured and incarcerated. But you know, it's The biggest problem then for the case against Chiafalo was the case against this district attorney and the investigator.
Right.
Because they fouled the evidence.
Exactly.
Or at least a portion thereof. I mean, the evidence against Chiafalo was crushing anyway. But it was just, it's this strange tale of a criminal case within a criminal case.
All based around comic books.
Yeah.
Which I still speculate as to,
you know,
why.
But for that aspect, comic books would never have been, they would be a footnote in the entire case. It was all about these bizarre amassing of disparate collectibles that would, you know, 20 different dealers in a large market would be the people who would own these things for resale.
I think the thing about
this two of them really, you know, meshing in their in what they had to offer. And here you have this guy like just grasping at every collectible he encounters in a huge way. It was like, you know, some like emir of Dubai going around, and you know, like there was a story years ago about this. I think it may have been an emir or somebody who was, you know, on holidays in England and went to this shop that had these two life-size stormtroopers flanking the doors, and he just, you know, I will buy these. And that's what it feels like. It's just, you know, here's this guy with this flush with unlimited stream of funds coming constantly, because when they searched the house, in addition to it being a museum full of collectibles, there were uncashed checks to the Chiafalos and to their fake corporations and their fake partner.
Right. I think the thing that hurt
they
me
hadn't even got around to
even bothering to cash those checks.
It's like Ty Webb in Caddyshack. Like, it's an uncashed check for $10,000. Keep it.
Keep it.
The summons? Cheers.
The thing that hurt me the most is the fact that of all the things that they had, you know, at their disposal, and all the they went and sold the comics, and they talked to, and they talk in the article to some of the buyers from the comics that show some remorse for buying stolen comics that because they ended up retrieving most of those comics for evidence. Yeah. So the people had to give them up because they were stolen. So the buyers had to give them up. They talked about how expensive it was, and it was a very, you know, it was a very expensive, teachable moment, essentially.
Yeah, a huge, costly lesson, but, you know, it's like the guy that gets a sweetheart deal on a Rolls Royce, but you know, a number of things, but
almost
where,
all
you know,
of
the
those,
cops say, oh, by the way, it's stolen.
Almost everything that they took in was retrieved. But the one thing that got taken into evidence and will never be put back into the market is that All-Star Comics number 3.
Oh, yes.
No one will ever be able to have that in a personal collection again. No one will ever be able to look to that comic.
And somehow it increases, it becomes like Goldfinger, because suddenly it increases
the
value. It's like, you know, it's that radioactive gold at Fort Knox. It's now untouchable.
Right, so I think that's the saddest thing.
I think maybe there was some kind of nefarious, you know, the next best copy.
Was that what it was? This was all a setup.
Oh yes, I find someone.
Blofeld has the 8.2 graded copy of All Star Comics number 3.
Mr. Bond, I expect you to pay more for your copy of All Star.
So yeah, and they go on. If you
stall, it's the stupidest plot you've ever come up with.
If you look at some of the other, if you just do a Google search, essentially what they say is that this is one of the top 10 embezzlement thefts of all time. This is a very expensive embezzlement theft that they went through that Chiafalo perpetrated, all based on. And then spending all of that money on comic books.
Yeah.
Just amazing to me. It's just amazing that...
And that was just a portion of these millions being spent on who knows what, you know. And we don't even really have the story about the disposition of all that other stuff that went into evidence. And it's... What's amazing is, okay, the guys that... The people that bought these high-end comics are now out their investment.
Right.
Because they were... You know, rounded up.
Yep.
But the people who the weird thing about the opposite side of the law is the people that sold stuff to Chiafalo.
Yeah.
There is no, thankfully, no legal precedent where they're forced to give the money back in exchange for what they sold.
Right. And, but the thing is...
It's so kind of weird that if you steal money...
Right.
You can do anything you want to with it. But if you steal goods then and you sell them for money, then the person who gave you that money can be out what they invested in.
And maybe this is just me.
And that, in a way, is yet again, these guys have stolen from somebody.
Exactly.
And it comes down to that. It's just as bad as having those books taken off the wall at the convention that we talked about early on about
exactly.
the comic book pilfering. Or at your shop, and you know how disheartening for those guys.
Exactly, that's what I was just going to say. Is
you know, in a way, you have no one to blame but yourself for your you know jumping on that. But at the same time, do you want to miss out on a? There's a prestige issue there, I think, with a lot of these dealers. You know, to have the best and the rarest, and you know, it's easy to get caught up in the whirlwind of that.
Right. Right. All right, man. Well, I think we handled this case.
We did indeed, and I want to close this out. You know, we talked about this kind of an ironic twist, and a very unfortunate ironic twist, is that we really didn't have anyone, you know, we knew we had anecdotal tales of people that we knew of or, you know, heard of who had had various amounts of comics stolen. I talked about, you know, somebody helping themselves to the better subscription books. And
right.
In a bit of a bind back when I had the shop. And rather ironically, just 2 days ago, Ron Killensworth of Collected posted on Facebook. He was at Space City Con in Houston.
Yeah.
And apparently the people who were supposed to be helping him break down bailed on him. So, you know, I know what it's like to have little to no help. You know, it's just you or you and one other person having to break down a massive amount of stuff when you're exhausted from a full weekend. And, you know, it's just a drag on you psychologically already. And apparently as he's trying to load up his booth by himself while making a trip out to his car, some other dealer helped themselves to a wall of his comics.
Really? Jesus, man.
Stole a box of his wall books while he was taking a load out.
That's... awful. God. I am glad, for one, that this arc is over. We need to do some stuff to restore our faith in humanity, I think,
yeah,
after this story.
Yeah, we have kind of left it on a down note, and then I just made it worse.
But...
I didn't think that through very well, actually.
The next issue of Hey Kids Comics is our summer fun issue, so we promise you...
That's right. It's going to get a lot more fun.
Yeah, it's going to get kind of ridiculous up in this piece.
No depressing tales.
no more. Yeah, we'll save the depressing stuff for about another 3 or 4 months. We'll give you a nice palate cleanser for a while before we get real depressing again. But yeah, thank you for joining us on this journey. We really once we fleshed this out, it was really interesting to do the research on this and see how it all breaks down. You know, don't steal shit is what it comes down to. Give credit where credit is due. Don't steal shit. You know, don't...
Steal shit, Ant-Man.
Don't steal shit, Ant-Man. Trying to suck any dick on the way to the parking lot. Other Clerks quotes that I can come up with in my brain right now. But yeah, it's disheartening to see this. But on the flip side, to end it on a positive note, for every story like this... there are 1,000 other stories, like we talked about in the last issue, with people getting dressed up in their cosplay costumes and going to hospitals, with free comic book days, with just people getting together and talking about comics and opening discourse and dialogue and hanging out at their local comic shops and making connections and being genuinely awesome people. There are 1,000 more of them than there are these douchebags. So... don't let anything we've said discourage you, number one. And number two, understand that this community thrives on the community itself. And damn it if it's not the best community I've ever got to walk in. So
absolutely. And do yourself and everyone else a favor. Whenever possible, be those good guys.
Right, exactly. If you can institute a comic book random act of kindness, please do so. Gather up some old comics. Take them to a children's hospital. if you have a costume, wear it to a children's hospital. Go somewhere, do some charity, volunteer to help somebody at a convention. You know, that's a big one. That's a big one. If you know a comic book shop owner, if you know somebody that does conventions, volunteer to help. Believe me, they need it. They need it. But you guys are awesome. You guys don't do any of this stuff, right? Yeah, that's what I thought. Nobody out here does this crap. So, Cole, why don't you plug us up, and we'll get out of here and start preparing for us. I got to put sunscreen on for this summer fun episode.
Yeah, I mean, well, you do. I guess we both do. You're Irish, and I'm Scottish.
It's surprised we haven't fought and drank yet.
I'm literally, that's what they wrote the song, Whiter Shade of Pale, about. But that was just me walking around. You know, that's just,
everybody kept going, oh, a ghost!
Yeah.
Zoinks!
It's a ghost!
It's a ghost!
So, yes, we're coming to you from the ghostly, ghastly, hallowed halls of the Jedi Cole universe at JediCole.com. You can write to us at JCUmail@yahoo.com. Please do, and let us know any suggestions for future episodes or future issues, and let us know how you like the show, and ask us questions so we can do another HKC Presents. And you can look for the occasional tweet on Twitter at the Jedi Cole U. And I'm not even going to mention the YouTube channel because I'm still working on trying to get some content going there. But I just keep, you know, every time I get started on that, something else comes up. And it's like, oh, busy, busy day.
Well, you know, that, and we got some exciting tech news coming up in the near future. It's going to be awesome. Cole's been working diligently. If you're hearing this and you want to go back and listen to issues, Cole's been working his ass off to relink all of the issues that we have back through this show, back through the Rant Core Pit, anything that the JCU's done to make them listenable again. We had some issues with broken links and things like that. So
yes, as of this moment, as we're speaking, I believe from number 21. Straight through to number 180 of this show, I believe all episodes of the Rancor Pit, the pre-recorded show, all episodes of What'd You Think, and Figments, and Do It Yourself, a number of the other shows all have been established with completely embedded content. So
there
now you just go to the individual posts and you click the button and it will just start playing away for you.
That's awesome.
No more jumping to a different link. That particular feature stopped embedding for me a couple of years ago and I just stopped bothering. I tried again recently. It's new and improved and it's working. So I am diligently, by the time you hear this, I want to say that the entire JCU will be restored in that way, and then I'll be going and meticulously reestablishing viable, viewable Rancor Pit Live, and ideally Hey Kids Comics Live.
Very good.
Just click on the click on it and view it, because for right now it's kind of this weird redirect. I think everything's still there. It just doesn't look like it's there, so I don't want anybody to think that the stuff's gone.
Well, the idea is that we made a conscious decision to up our stock in technology this year. We're gonna make some big, pretty big sweeping changes in the near future to make things a little more accessible, a little more fun, a little more 2000 and change versus where we were. It's just time. You guys are worth our time. You guys are worth the time we can put into, you know, all of the changes that we're making. So, and we wouldn't be doing it if it weren't for you guys. So thank you so much, everybody that's out there that's listening, that gives us feedback, that talks to us about the shows, that guests on our shows. You guys are amazing, and we wouldn't do it without you. So with all that being said, Cole, thank you for going on this 5-issue story arc journey into madness with me. I appreciate that.
Yes, thank you. And also, thank you to everybody who stuck with us when we took a couple of breaks with the What'd You Think crossovers. And we're happy to have brought you to the conclusion of this arc.
I feel like I can sleep again. I don't feel like I've slept in 6 weeks because of the research for this and looking at Dirty Dirty Douchebags doing Dirty Dirty Douchebags things, the little AC/DC playing in my head on a loop all the time. But yeah, so join us next week. Summer fun episode coming out, coming at you. It's going to be funny. It's going to be ridiculous. And, you know, it goes without saying that as we conclude this story arc and another, I mean, we're coming up on 200 hot and heavy, that none of this would be possible without Cole allowing us and building a playground for all of us that do his shows to play in. So, Cole, thank you so much for that. It means everything to me, and I think it means a whole lot to a lot of people out there. So I just wanted to come be on record saying thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome, and I'm thrilled with how the JCU has grown and expanded. And, I'm very fortunate to work with some incredible people along those lines.
All right, let's get out of here. We'll see you next week. Don't forget, buy, collect, and enjoy your comics. Do it all legally, for the love of God.
Absolutely, please.
Legally. Good night, everybody. Say good night, Cole.
Good night, everybody.
Hommes lui tournaient autour en espérant l'amour. Voilà, bohémien, c'est ainsi que l'on parlait d'elle et de sa famille. Voilà, bohémien, et toutes les nuits, les hommes lui tournaient autour en espérant l'amour. Voilà,
bohémien, c'est ainsi que l'on parlait d'elle et de sa
famille. Magnificent, maleficent. Magnificent, maleficent. Mini mumbling mice were making merry music in the moonlight.
The thing was about the corpulent porpoises.
Corpulent porpoises. Corpulent porpoises. Corpulent porpoises.
Yeah, some sort of little thing you would say.